All right. You know I'm a foodie, right? I love to cook delicious new recipes and play around with flavor. But when I'm on the go, I also love delicious, ready-to-eat meals by Factor. I discovered Factor about a year ago when I was ready to really make a change, again, in my nutrition and fitness. It was important to me to get healthy, dietitian-approved meals that I knew were good for me and, most importantly, ready in 2 minutes. Factor is fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted. It's been a savior for me and Bobby when we need a quick meal or even when we're traveling in the Airstream and at a campsite. Factor was the perfect pairing when we were last camping in Yosemite National Park and had the sun-dried tomato chicken and zoodle meal. Oh my God. Even Bobby was like, wow, we need to get this again. It's so good. But imagine sitting fireside with an easy, delicious, premium meal, no cleanup, no mess. Bonus, we had plenty of time for those fireside s'mores. And speaking of being in nature, Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for Factor's lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/thebigsilence50 and use the Big Silence 50 for 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That code is thebigsilence50 at factormeals.com/thebigsilence50. Let me know what your fave Factor meal is because I want to try it too.
The American Academy of Pediatrics did say it was okay to perform gastric bypass on children, but number two, that it was okay to prescribe these drugs. I don't even remember a time in my life where anxiety was not present. I was a perfectionist. I was a people pleaser. To make that perfect storm all come together, I was also a ballet dancer.
And I might throw myself under the bus and some people might not like this, but I do believe that this whole weight loss drug, Ozempic, and all of the other ones are almost a eating disorder epidemic.
An innocent diet ended up turning into a very almost deadly eating disorder.
How old were you?
11 and a half. Recovering from my eating disorder was the hardest thing I ever did. And I've done a lot of things in my life.
The Big Silence.
Welcome back to The Big Silence. It's Karina here, as always. So happy that you are here joining for yet another episode. I love that a lot of you are sharing these episodes with your friends, commenting and leaving reviews. That is so helpful to make sure we spread the word and awareness of self-development and the importance of taking care of your mental health and all of these deep dives into really important conversations. Today's podcast is Joanna Candle. I'm very excited to have Joanna on the podcast. I recorded this when I was in Palm Springs. So if you go to YouTube, you can see the video there. But I get a lot of questions around this particular topic of eating disorders. Trigger warning, sometimes these conversations we have here can trigger. But we have the conversations that no one else is willing to have. So Joanna Candle is the founder and CEO of the National Alliance for Eating Disorders and the author of Life Beyond Your Eating Disorder. She founded the Alliance after a decade-long battle with various eating disorders. And since founding the Alliance in October 2000, so it's been around for 24 years almost, Joanna has brought information and awareness about eating disorders to hundreds of thousands of individuals nationally and internationally. Saving lives out there, Joanna. We talk about all sorts of things and growing up in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, the pressures that women have. We talk about Ozempic and could this possibly be a new ED epidemic? Joanna has been so accomplished in the world of ED awareness. She's a proud member of the Interdepartmental Serious Mental Illness Coordinating Committee meeting under the Department of Health and Human Services. She's the treasurer of the and board of directors for Eating Disorders Coalition and a member of the Collective of Eating Disorders Advocacy and a member of the Collective of Eating Disorders Organizations. Wow, she's got a lot of accolades here. So she has received so many awards for her ongoing outreach and advocacy work, including actually the Jefferson Award for Public Services, which is the highest and most prestigious honor recognizing public service in the United States. I'm so excited to have this. I get a lot of questions too, because in my Big Silence memoir, I touch on the topic of eating disorder, but I didn't go really deep into it. I think at the time in writing my book, I was a little still shy because of the stigma around it. And this is something that I also suffered from as a teenager and very young adult. But in the audiobook that I just finished recording last week, I did bonus questions and interviews with my friend. And so we really dive deeper into so many different topics in the memoir, but especially also the ED. So that is releasing in May. So make sure you sign up for the newsletter and stay in the know for all details and podcast tour. All right, put your hands together for Joanna Candle. Let's go.
All right, welcome to the podcast, Joanna Candle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, as I've already mentioned, you're the founder of National Alliance of Eating Disorders, which is a conversation I really haven't had here yet. We were just catching up prior to recording this, and you were coming from Palm Beach, Florida, and you were saying that it's not like Palm Royale.
A little bit, maybe the clicky part of it and that part, but no, it's very entertaining, and I'm so happy that that show exists. And we're seeing more and more shows center around Palm Beach, so it's going to be really interesting to see, but yeah.
All right, so we're here to talk about eating disorders. And again, this can be possibly a triggering conversation for some, but a much needed conversation, as here at the Big Silence, we are talking about the things that we don't really talk about. I feel like EDs are one of the most things when you talk about mental health that are not talked about, because they're very private.
The part of my job that I focus on the most is ensuring that eating disorders are part of the general mental health conversation. I can't even begin to tell you how many people do not associate eating disorders as mental health disorders. Oftentimes, people view them as a disease of vanity, a disease of choice, but they are actually biologically based brain illnesses. They are genetic in nature, and they are absolutely serious mental illness.
Okay, so before we dive into that, how did you get to where you are now?
As you were talking about before, I think that, you know, working in this space, we all have our whys. And for me, my why was my experience with my eating disorder. You know, I grew up at a time where no one was talking, not only about mental illness, but definitely not about eating disorders. And I think that we've come so far talking about mental health. I think we're talking now more openly about depression and anxiety and substance use. And yet, I will say that we're still not talking about eating disorders as much as other parts of this mental health conversation. So I do want to just pause and say thank you for creating this space and for providing individuals an opportunity to be seen, really. Because I think so often that's what I hear is that, oh, we hear about everything else. We do not hear about this. So thank you for providing that. The way that I got connected to this work was, you know, I was someone who was genetically predisposed to have an eating disorders. They ran rampantly in my family. Some of my loved ones actually had eating disorders that weren't even coined at the time that they were struggling with them. So I had that genetic predisposition. I also have a history of, when you look at me, I have transgenerational trauma in my family. My father was a Holocaust survivor. I was also born with anxiety. I don't even remember a time in my life where anxiety was not present. I was a perfectionist. I was a people pleaser. To make that perfect storm all come together, I was also a ballet dancer. So all of that. And for me, my eating disorder started at the age of 11 and a half. I was told to go on a diet alongside all of the other humans in my ballet class. And for me, an innocent diet ended up turning into a very almost deadly eating disorder.
How old were you?
11 and a half.
Isn't that so interesting? We'll pick up from there. But I took ballet and I was not professional, not trying to go any. But my mother put me into a ballet class. And I was actually talking to my sister, who's our executive director, prior to this. And we were talking about growing up and our mom always restricting us. And then I was in a ballet class and they were like, even the teacher back then in Indiana was like, if she's going to do ballet, she needs to lose weight. And I'm like, I'm this tiny little twiggly kid.
Exactly. 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 And if you have that predisposition of having the characteristics to have that all or nothing, black or white, succeed at all costs mentality, which I did, you know, you hear something like that and you're like, well, of course. And ballet was my world. Like from the age of you know, seven, I was dancing 5 days a week and spending my summers in New York. And so for me, if they would have said, you know, we need you to, you know, grand jeté off the top of this building, I probably would too. And so, you know, I think it's really important for people that are listening to hear this is I didn't intentionally set out to develop an eating disorder. It wasn't like at 11 and a half, I like looked out the window and said it was a beautiful day and insert, you know, Palm Beach, right? Today, I think I'm going to have anorexia. It was really the epitome of that quote, the path to hell is filled with good intentions, where like I went on this path. I was like, well, I want to get this role. So they told us we have to lose weight. So I don't know how to do it, but you know, this was, you know, the early 90s where it was like, you know, fat free was like the craze. And, you know, so I was like, well, you know, I mean, I can never look at another Snackwell cookie ever again for the rest of my life. So I see you totally. That's really how it started. I started restricting a little bit, exercising more. And I auditioned for this role and they pulled me aside and they said, you know, Joanna, you're the only one that didn't get the part. And they said, it's not because you're not a good dancer that you look so young. I was significantly younger than everyone else in my class. And that was the first time I had that game of telephone that a lot of people with eating disorders have of like, someone will say something and what you hear is totally different. And I just I promised myself that I would do better, that I would dance harder, be thinner, do all those things. And, you know, for me, that really did start my eating disorder. And, you know, unfortunately, we live in a world that's very embracive of, you know, lower weight type eating disorders. We also live in a very diet centric, very fat phobic world. And so the messaging that I was hearing as my weight was getting lower and lower was, you're doing great. You have amazing willpower. All of that, that I'm sure many of your listeners could hear. You know, and I mean, for me, my eating disorder continued until I was 21 years old. And I struggled with restricting anorexia, with bulimia, with binge eating disorder, with orthorexia, you name it, I struggled with it. Came very close several times to losing my life. And ultimately, I had this moment after ballet was taken away from me because I was so ill that the fear of changing was a little bit less than my desire to just see what life was like outside of the hell that I was living in. And it's very important for me to share it. Like, I didn't have a magical recovery journey. It wasn't like a flip of a switch where, I mean, it was bumpy as hell. It was one step forward, three steps back, two steps forward. And because my family didn't have the finances, I wasn't able to get the care that I needed because at that time I was living in a much, much larger body. People were like, oh, well, you should just diet. And I was barely eating anything, but just was still in a much larger body. And no one knew. They knew nothing. The people that should have known knew nothing. And so that was really the instigation between starting the Alliance. My experience became the blueprint of creating this organization. And so I graduated from undergrad. I was getting ready to go to grad school and get my PhD in clinical psychology. And I decided to take a year and see what would happen. And this October will be 24 years that I started the Alliance.
Wow. Thank you. And congratulations. It's hard work.
Yes.
What you do. And how many, through the Alliance, I have so many questions, but through the Alliance, how many people have you helped?
I don't think I would be exaggerating if I said we're probably over the million mark. Last year alone, we provided over 260,000 referrals to care for individuals for all levels of care, from a therapist to a dietitian, all the way up to acute medical stabilization. And have had over 20,000 participants in our free weekly therapist-led support groups. So I hope that's our number. You know, again, there's this saying that, you know, if you save one person, you save the world. And I just want to be a helper. I want to be able to pay it forward.
Hey, we're speaking the same language over here. But okay, so I am not as educated on eating disorders, and I am so excited to learn more about it. I have some thoughts about today's current society, which we'll get there. But still staying, I didn't realize there was it was genetic or a predisposition.
Yeah, out of all the factors that contribute to eating disorders, about 50 to 70% is genetic. So we know that there's actually markers that give you this predisposition. And if a parent or a sibling of a parent has had an eating disorder, you have a 12 times more likely chance to develop an eating disorder. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will happen. It just gives you that predisposition. And for me, my mom did not have an eating disorder. Two of her sisters did, and my father's sister also had an eating disorder. So to say that I was genetically screwed is an understatement. But again, I needed all of those inherent traits along with the environment to come together to create that perfect storm.
Yeah, I know. And again, as I talked to my sister, Rachel, executive director of The Big Silence, and just our journey with our mom, and she put us on those diet shakes back then and those fat-free this, that, and we're like, okay, you know, eat as much as that. But I want to talk about, again, this is the 90s, and I'm sure now it's out there with the kids. But I learned about EDs through watching a TV show that my parents had on TV. And I was like, oh, I've never heard of bulimia. Like, what is that? And then it intrigued me. And then I started doing it. My mom was already in the 90s diet culture.
Sure.
And I'm like, okay, she wanted my sister and I to be like very slim. And so I developed that ED. How do we protect our kids? How do we educate and protect?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I will tell you, I learned so many, I want to say tricks or tips to become better at my eating disorder from after school movies. The first time I ever saw anybody publicly struggle with an eating disorder, it was Tracy Gold on Growing Pains. She had left the show. And then there was a series of, I like to call them after school movies. They were like Lifetime movies. Like For the Love of Nancy was one of them that literally taught me how to become better at my eating disorder. There was a lot of eating disorder memoirs, for example, that I would read not as a, okay, I want to get inspired to recover, but more of like, how can I become better at this? Because there is that perfectionistic component to it. As a response to your question, I think being active observers in the content that your kids are interacting with. So for example, social media is something that, you know, we can't have a conversation about eating disorders in today's world without talking about social media. Be very cautious on who they follow, what trends they're paying attention to. Having that open dialogue of, you know, what they see online or what they're hearing from their peers. As a parent of a seven-year-old, I mean, those conversations have already started, right? Like one of the things that I try so hard in my household to say is, number one is there's no good food or bad food. All food is food. We shouldn't put morality attached to it. There's some foods that are, you know, more nutritious and that are more helpful. Not making comments about bodies, not ridiculing certain body types, not making the assumption that, you know, that weight equals health. Also, and I think just being there to be inviting for that conversation to happen, but also being well aware of the content that they're consuming.
Yeah, I mean, if we grew up when we grew up and we were able to receive content, I can't imagine what our youth now is able to receive through social media. So there's got to be so much, I don't know, I just couldn't imagine growing up in today's day and age and the pressures of it. Because obviously as we've grown and learned and educated and become more confident and knowing all of this, like we have the resources, but our youth definitely needs help. So you said that you were near, like you almost lost your life through your Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I ended up in the hospital in the cardiac care unit because that was at the time when I was restricting. I had a very low body weight. And one thing that I tell people all the time is that it doesn't matter what size body you are or what type of eating disorder you are, you can absolutely have malnourishment. And I think that that is a misconception that, you know, eating disorders come in just a certain way. Out of all individuals that are experiencing eating disorders, only 6% are medically underweight. So the majority of folks that experience eating disorders are in all shapes and sizes of bodies. The other thing that I would say is that eating disorders do not discriminate. For the longest time, I mean, I think even to this day, people think, oh, eating disorder, oh, it's a female identifying person. You do see an overrepresentation of females that have eating disorders, but they absolutely happen to males. It doesn't matter whether your gender, your race, your culture, your ability, your neurodiversity, your body shape and size, you can experience an eating disorder. So for me, it was, you know, medical ramifications. It also was that my eating disorder did cause me to want to end my life. So I did have a suicide attempt. And, you know, I have so much gratitude for the gift that I have been given. And I think that that's why I'm still so closely connected to this work. And after, you know, people share with me all the time, they ask me, they're like, it's 23 years and this is a lot. And why are you doing it? And my answer truly is because I can, because I was given this gift, this opportunity. And I just don't want people to suffer alone. And that's really what it comes down to. There's so much, you know, and that's why I love so much of what you're doing, is because this idea that, you know, shame breeds in isolation. And what I always envisioned for the Alliance was to be that conduit of light, because we know that when we bring light in, it just makes it just a little bit easier. And that when I said that, you know, the Alliance is the blueprint of what I wish I had had, one of those big parts was, at that time, I mean, there wasn't like Zoom or anything, but what I wanted was to be in a room where people spoke my language, that inherently they could say something and I could just, without saying a word, say me too, just because I wouldn't feel so alone. And so that's really so much of why we created this community of support, is that we want people to know that they are not alone.
Okay. We are speaking the same language. Also, a suicide survivor, and why I do the work with the Big Silence. So no one has everything you just said. So yes. our adults, anyone doesn't have to suffer and know that you're not alone and it's okay.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing. So, you know, having an eating disorder can lead to depression. And so there's probably multiple layers there, sort of like if you're I'm going to throw this out. Like, say you're an addict of whatever your choice, but are you covering something else? So do you think your eating disorder, like with an eating disorder, possibly covering up a depression or something, like something that you can control?
Yeah. So a lot of people say that eating disorders are maladaptive coping mechanism, right? That typically we know that anxiety is typically present, whether it's depression, whether it's PTSD, you know, that a lot of individuals that experience eating disorders have a history of trauma. Not everyone, but there is a trauma there. About 50% of individuals that will experience an eating disorder will have a co-occurrent substance use disorder. And it's one of those things where it's like, you know, with the eating disorder first, and then you start using substances as, you know, appetite suppressants or things of that sort. So we truly always say that eating disorders are never in that proverbial car alone, which is why when you are on the journey to recovery, if you're able to have access to care, it's really important to have a multidisciplinary team that will not just treat the eating disorder, because again, it's like you'll start playing this game of whack-a-mole. It's really the understanding of all the factors that are at play. So absolutely, I know that, you know, my eating disorder, absolutely, for me, it was a way of coping with my low self-esteem, ever feeling good enough, anxiety. It was a way of numbing. It really was. And also a way of feeling like in my life where I didn't have control, it was this elusive form of control that I felt, well, you know what? I can't control what's going on over here or there, but I can control what's going on in here.
Yeah. Okay. So I've been reading studies that since COVID-19, eating disorders are multiplied by hundreds of percent. So let's talk about that. I have some stats of restrictive food intake jumped by 305% since COVID-19, binge eating by 81%, anorexia by 73%, and then bulimia 3%. So COVID-19 has just enhanced EDs. Why is that?
Well, I want to take you back to, I remember this date. I will never forget this date. It was Friday, March 13th, 2020. And at that point, we had 24 in-person support groups across the country. And I started getting calls in from my facilitators saying, oh, you know, our community center where we hold our group, the church, the synagogue, wherever it is, they're going to close for 2 weeks, right? That the proverbial 2 weeks. And I remember calling up our clinical director and saying to her, I was like, shit. I was like, COVID-19 has the making of wreaking havoc for individuals with eating disorders because number one, it was this collective anxiety, the unknown. And it caused us to be physically distant from individuals, staying in our home, our lives literally flip-flopping within the matter of a few days, in a sense, right? So when you look at all those factors, right, that isolation, that uncertainty, the anxiety, that maybe not having access to the foods that you typically eat, I mean, or maybe being in a home with foods that could be particularly very triggering, all of that came together. And we saw, right, like mental health disorders spike in general. Like we saw, you know, increases in suicidality, increases in depression and anxiety, but eating disorders specifically we saw. And, you know, it can be a myriad of all of that. It could also be how much time people spend online too, and these messages that we're seeing online. So we think it's a combination of a lot. And when I tell you treatment centers were on 6 to 9 month wait lists during that time, like we clinicians were extremely overbooked. There was, we had this one time where we called for individuals looking for treatment in Massachusetts. And it was the 16th call of the day for looking for providers in Massachusetts. And our director of our helpline services came into my office crying. And she's like, there's no one. There's no one anymore. What do we do? What do we do? And so I think it was this universal collective, holy shit, how are we going to cope? And so we saw this raise of individuals struggling with their eating disorders for the first time. But then we also saw a lot of people that had been in recovery that had relapsed.
Do you think it's getting better now since?
I'm going to say yes. And I will also share with you that in the months of January and February of this year, we had a 300% increase in calls to our helpline over this time last year. So I don't know if that is a result of things getting worse or more people knowing about our services. So when we talk about social media, I think it's a both and conversation. I think there can be so much wonderfulness amongst the community building of social media when the world went dark within 24 hours of the lockdown. There was 24-hour meal support on Instagram. Dietitians just donating their time, having meals around the clock, which was beautiful. Also, we are the resource for all social media companies. So if people are seeking help or they're looking for like maybe a keyword, our information comes up. So we connect to, they connect to us to connect to service. And then on the flip side, we know that it takes generally about 8 minutes on social media to get eating disorder content thrown at you. So again, like these types of algorithms, these type of, you know, what do I eat in a day? Or, you know, this is, you know, the whole Ozempic, you know, like literally on, you know, on the special last week with Oprah, you know, I think it was one of the people from the pharmaceutical companies. They're talking about how long Ozempic has been around and they said, what has changed? And I think one of the pharma people said, TikTok, right? Like, so again, this massive information at your hands at all times.
I do want to go into that, but what is your helpline number?
Absolutely. So our helpline number is 866-662-1235. And just so your listeners know, when they call that helpline, all of our helpline is staffed by licensed and specialized therapists in the treatment of eating disorders. They are wonderful humans that are kind, compassionate, and are ready and willing to help. So please do not hesitate to pick up the phone and call us.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll put that in the show notes and we'll put it as a resource on thebigsilence.com. So, Ozempic. And I had not watched the Oprah special until last night because we were talking. And I wanted to educate myself more on these weight loss drugs. And I want to leave Oprah out of the conversation.
100%. It's her journey. It's her bodily autonomy. Absolutely.
Yeah. But I might throw myself under the bus and some people might not like this, but I do believe that this whole weight loss drug, Ozempic and all of the other ones are almost a eating disorder epidemic. This has been my thought. I was the person during COVID that ate way too much. My husband and I were like, let's eat pizza and pasta and all this stuff. And then I was like, you're isolated and not working out. And, I had gained 30 pounds, but then, and in my community, they're like, how did Karina lose weight? And they're like, she must be on Ozempic. I was like, no, I'm a fitness person. I'm healthy. I got out in nature. I work out. I got healthy again. It was a very hard time for everyone. And to go through that trauma takes a very long time to get out of it. But from what I witnessed through people that I love personally, that there's two different types. The people that are pre-diabetic, diabetic, who I believe the drug is necessary for. And I've talked to many people that I know that are interested in it, but it's very expensive. But then I know these girls that are younger or even my age who are fit and in the fitness industry or in wellness, and they're doing it. I'm like, but you don't need it. So then you have to continue this very expensive drug. Or then what happens when you decide, I'm not going to spend $800,000 a month on this, and I'm going back? Like, I worry about the epidemic that's going to happen after. And this might not be like a favorable conversation for some, but that's just my opinion.
Absolutely. So one of the things that, and again, I always preface when I talk about this to say, whatever you choose to do is your choice. I really, like I said, this is, how we're not talking about Oprah. Like, I do believe in one's bodily autonomy 100%. And we did. So the Alliance, in collaboration with 25 other eating disorder organizations, put out a statement as a result of the special. And it wasn't, again, to your point, it wasn't directed at Oprah. It was just about this larger GLP-1 conversation. Individuals that need it for their diabetes, that is not part of the conversation that I'm having currently. One of the things that I have a lot of fear around is that there's no screening taking place before prescribing the drug. So there's no screening or eating disorder conversation. So individuals, for example, that might have a history of an eating disorder, might be genetically predisposed to having an eating disorder, that might have disordered eating or an unhealthy relationship with food and body, are getting this drug. And for a lot of individuals, eating disorders, again, from that mindset of their maladaptive coping tools. So what if, for example, they're using food to numb, to stuff, to escape, to your point, to make it through a really scary time that we collectively all went through, right, during the pandemic? You're going to end up symptom substituting. And individuals that are genetically predisposed, when they get into negative energy balance, which they will with Ozempic, and get under their body set point, that's when that fear of the development of eating disorders will happen. Not to mention that we're also starting to prescribe it. And this was something that the American Academy of Pediatrics did at the beginning of last year, is not only did they say it was okay to perform gastric bypass on children, but number two, that it was okay to prescribe these drugs. I know that there is research on these drugs in the context of diabetes, so I'm not touching that, but we don't know the long-term effects of these drugs on individuals that are using it for weight loss. I have a lot of fear around getting our kiddos involved with that. All to say, I have a lot of fear. And also, there's a lot of side effects that are happening that are very similar to the side effects of eating disorders. Gastroparesis is happening to a lot. Pancreatitis is happening to a lot of folks. And so I would say, of course, your journey is your journey, but proceed with caution. And I just wish that eating disorder was part of this conversation, because to your point, I do think we're going to see this enormous jump of individuals that are struggling as a result of this.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. So, and one of the side effects is if you've had clinical depression before and you've been treated and then you could go on this drug, then you could have a spike in your clinical depression. And mm-hmm. I know some people that are like, I want to try it because I actually need it. But are worried about the depression. And so, you know, there's a lot. And again, you got to figure out what's right for you. I do worry about people that I love and in my circle doing it and what may. And I do know some people who have had clinical depression that are now on it that don't need to be on it. But, you know, it's something to talk about more. And I worry about that. And I worry, you know, even in our culture, we went from being inclusive to very exclusive now.
Yep. And I will tell you that, you know, what we've heard a lot on our lines and in our support group is, you know, individuals that are in recovery and they're living life in a larger body and they're completely healthy. And they're being told that they need to go on this, right? Because it's according to a BMI chart or something along those lines. And how much harm we're doing for that. You know, I will tell you that recovering from my eating disorder was the hardest thing I ever did, bar none. And I've done a lot of things in my life. We live in a world that is not embracive of eating disorder recovery, right? Like anywhere you turn, you know, weight loss, diets, it's our country's favorite pastime. I think it surpasses football very truthfully. And, you know, to get these messages thrown at you all the time that there's something wrong with your body, even when you know that, like, my body is healthy, like my labs are great, my heart is great, my this is that, but because you're deeming my body to be not what you think it needs to be, I think it's creating very dangerous spaces for individuals. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of more people that are struggling.
So, okay, say you're healthy. Let's talk about, how do I say this? I feel like I'm going to get people that are going to be upset with what I say, but there are people out there who body shame. And I feel that perhaps there's some projection. So what would you say to the person who's on the other side of the screen that goes on and body shames other people? What would you say to them?
In the United States, weight is the last acceptable discrimination out there. I think that in all states besides Michigan and a few cities across the country, you can actually be fired based on your body shape and size, which blows my mind. What I would do is I would replace body shaming with another term. Like, would you ever, and maybe it is who you are and, you know, but would you ever shame someone because of the color of their skin, because of their heritage, because of their ability, because of their, would you do that? And if the answer is no, then I'm going to gently ask you to incorporate body shaming in that as well, because individuals, are constantly being shamed for the size of their body. And it is unacceptable. It is just completely unacceptable. So please, if you have the inclination to do that, take a breath and just remember, like, our words of please don't do that. It inflicts so much harm. And people don't deserve that.
Yeah, I 100,000% agree with that. So how do we help any listeners, community, or Big Silence, or Tone It Up? Like, how do we help make a difference? How do I personally help? What do we do?
Well, I think the first step is exactly what you're doing right now, is you're creating space for this conversation to happen. If we don't talk about it, it isn't talked about. And the more that we can talk about it, the more we make it okay to have conversations and ask for help. So thank you for doing that. And then also is, you know, just be aware, if you are struggling with an eating disorder, please know that you are not alone. Please know that There is no shame. You did not choose this. You did not cause this. That there is help, that there is hope. And, you know, please know that we are here to support you. We have our helpline. We have our free therapist-led support groups that are virtual. We have them 6 days a week. So it's really easy to access. We have people from all 50 states, 83 countries around the world that attend our group. So please know that there's help and support. And if you're listening and you know someone that has an eating disorder, you know, it's something that you actually said right before we started recording is that eating disorders, mental health disorders, they do not just happen to the person that is struggling. It happens to the family system. If you love someone who's experiencing an eating disorder, know that we see you and that you need care and support also. We have specific groups for loved ones of individuals that are experiencing eating disorders, so we can help arm you with the tools that you need. If you are able, please go and get the help and support you need from an individual therapist, a caregiver therapist. If you think someone you know is struggling with an eating disorder, you just don't know how to approach them, one thing that I will say is, first and foremost, you can reach out to us, visit our website, get the information you need. And when you talk to the person, make sure that it's just you and them. Come at it using I statements. I'm worried about you. I care about you. I've noticed. I'm so sorry that this is happening to you. Please know how I can help you. You do not have to go through this alone. And if they turn around and say, I don't know what you're talking about, like, you know, just say, okay, and I'm here to support you. I'm here to be here when you're ready, if you're ready, whatever I can do. So just know that you do not have to walk this path alone, that there are people and organizations like the Alliance that cannot wait to be a support mechanism for you.
Yeah, that's great advice. I want to double point out the not pointing the finger at someone and just being supportive and not putting the blame on anyone, being gentle. And yeah, just being loving. That's, yeah. Well, Joanna, thank you so much for all the work that you do. I love hearing more and more about your programs, and we're going to share all of it on thebigsilence.com/resources and show notes, all the things. I appreciate you dedicating your life to this and helping other people. I feel you. I know. And it's not easy. And it's, you know, in this space too, coming out of your own struggles, possibly for myself, sometimes you have these triggers and it can be exhausting, but you just keep going and together with more people like you, like making the world a better place. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And ditto. I know that that's such a simple word, but it really, you know, for those of us that have been through hell and back, I think everyone's pretty much been through hell and back, but in this context, my husband asked me recently, he's like, so how long do you think you're going to, you know, he loves the Alliance more than anything. He's like, but how long do you think that you're going to do this? And I said, until I no longer have a voice. I do it for that 11-year-old version of me who felt like she didn't deserve to take up space or be seen. I do it for the countless amount of phone calls that we get where, you know, people have been struggling in silence for 30, 40, 50 years, for people that genuinely need and deserve help. And because of the lack of access to care, they're not able to get the care that they need. And mostly I do it for my 7-year-old child, because I want her to live in a world where every 52 minutes, someone is not dying as a direct result of their eating disorder. I'll just continue to show up. And I really appreciate you continuing to show up, because you make the world a better place. And I'm so proud to share space with you and to be in community with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today and every Wednesday. If you loved this episode or think a loved one could benefit from listening, please share. And follow us on Facebook and Instagram at the.big.silence. Head over to thebigsilence.com to sign up for our newsletter to stay in the loop for live events coming up and details on the release of my memoir, The Big Silence. And as always, we'd love a like, subscribe, and leave a review on anywhere the podcast can be found. I love you, and I will see you next Wednesday.
The Big Silence. The Big Silence.